Hello, everyone. Joshua Gilliland here, attorney blogger on The Legal Geeks. And with me today is Cherry O'Brien, novelist and political consultant, to talk about Agent Carter. Cherry, how are you?
Hey, Josh. Great episode last night. Probably my favorite since the pilot.
I agree. And we, Iron Ceiling, fantastic. It was...
Wahoo!
It was a geek dream come true. Keep that up. Plus, the Daredevil teaser.
Yeah. So. I've seen the full teaser trailer this morning, and you only get a glimpse of the Kingpin from behind, but it's beginning to look like they nailed it.
Exactly. Having him in all black is a nice little homage to his appearance in the Incredible Hulk special they did in the mid-80s. And eventually they'll get him into the red one. I would hope that I wouldn't mind seeing a yellow and black one, but I'm kind of a traditionalist that way. But it's, I love having a lawyer superhero. It's like, God bless you. Fan-freaking-tastic to have that. So, but let's talk about the other greatness, and that's Agent Carter that just continues to impress. And Iron Ceiling was just a rip-roaring good time. So, your thoughts?
Well, Haley Atwell, as usual, is just terrific. Neil McDonough as Dum-Dum Dugan and the leader of the Howling Commandos was fabulous. And even some of the characters that we haven't like Thompson, her fellow SSR agent, you saw a different side of him, that he obviously has a bad case of PTSD. And as we found by the end of the episode, he's technically also a war criminal because he shot some unarmed men who were trying to surrender. He feels guilt about it, which I guess is a good thing. But, you know, there's a lot going on there beneath the surface. He's not just the, you know, the asshole that we've thought he was.
My feeling on a lot of these guys is we see them as misogynistic jerks. I mean, just like, no question, you want to go smack them. It's like, what's wrong with you? But that doesn't mean that they're bad people, which is a very complicated statement to make, because these are characters that fought in the biggest global conflict that we had in the scope of humanity, that saw horrible things, that did horrible things in war, and are having a really tough time dealing with it. And the fact that Thompson was the guy that said, not everyone came home needing a hug, you know, in reference to the last episode.
Yeah.
He kind of needs a hug. He looks like he went through the ringer, and the Pacific War wasn't exactly a cakewalk. He probably went through hell.
And as we said before, when we talked about the pilot episode of Agent Carter, one of the things that I know you enjoy as much as I do is that when they show some of these misogynistic idiots who work with her, who treat her like a glorified secretary or coffee maker, they're multidimensional characters. They're not just a bunch of misogynists. They generally, besides having that fault, they generally know how to do their job. They're good at other things. And in a couple of the episodes, they've only been one step behind her, you know, as good as she is. And we saw that again last night.
Yeah, a lot of these guys seem to be a few therapy sessions and a sensitivity class behind being what we would consider socially acceptable today. That they need help, they need time to heal and grow, but they're not the bad guys, even though they might be doing really insensitive, stupid things to Agent Carter. And that's fascinating to see characters written like that, because the writers could very easily make them all despicable and make it easy for the audience to hate them, as opposed to sympathize with them while also being upset with them. It's really fascinating.
They're doing a very good job of that. I'd like to see a lot more of Dottie, the next door neighbor, who is obviously a very trained assassin. My money says she's probably, you know, Hydra or Leviathan or one of those groups. And they haven't come out and said it, but who knows? She could end up being Natasha's grandma.
There are a couple things about Dottie that I found perplexing. She killed who I thought was an agent of Leviathan, who was trying to get Stark. So does that make Dottie a rogue agent from Leviathan who's escaped? Is she working for somebody else? Or is she just crazy? Because she's doing like the weird fatal attraction.
The single white female at the mirror, you know, mimicking Agent Carter's voice, obsessing over her photo of Steve Rogers. There's a lot of strange going on there.
Yeah. I mean, like, on the level of creepy, if we define the creepiest thing in cinema as Deliverance, and a step below that, Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs with that horrific dance scene in the nude, we're a few levels below that, but it's still uber creepy.
I'd say she's a six on that scale. And maybe it's because they turned Bridget Regan into a blonde. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but I would like to lodge a protest. You know, those of you who've seen Bridget Regan in other shows, other genre shows, a very stunning brunette, why they made her a blonde, I don't know. There should be an investigation.
I agree. Senate confirmation hearings need to be held and find out why that took place. That being said, it is weird. It is super weird. What is she up to? And then you can see the psychological damage she had from being, and what I will call the charm school, and more on that in a moment, that she handcuffs herself before going to bed and does the ritualistic behaviors that she learned in 1937 in what would be the worst boarding school ever. And being indoctrinated into how to kill a classmate.
Yeah, you know, talk about conditioning. Snapping the neck of a fellow schoolgirl on command from a teacher. You know, the handcuffs at night, going to bed.
Whew. Breaking bread and sharing it. Just very, not that sharing's weird, but the breaking of the bread. I mean, all of this was very, she was indoctrinated. Conditioned, Skinnerian box, whatever you want to call it. Very odd, and I don't know if she will help Agent Carter when Carter's on the run, or who she's working for, and she could be her on her own.
Well, her moves are literally a recreation of Natasha's moves, the Black Widow's moves from Iron Man 2, for example, and from the Avengers. So I would suspect that she's part of the Black Widow training, whether she's become a rogue agent, whether she's not working at full capacity, and maybe the conditioning had an effect on her and made her lose it. Don't know. But she obviously sees some kind of a relationship that exists between her and Peggy Carter. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens, because, you know, the foreshadowing seems to be that it is her destiny to kill Agent Carter from the breaking of the bread.
Agreed. Yeah, but look at the writing. I'm like, we are intrigued. We are talking about it, and we are engaged by it. So, job well done.
You're doing something right, that's for sure. It was a great episode, and you know, we talked earlier about how nice it was that Peggy Carter, when asked about New York City, she articulated something we've all known, which is, of course, that Brooklyn is the heart of New York City. I thought that was a nice touch. You know, something we were talking earlier about Dooley, and I think you said that he's a very methodical guy. He's doing his job. He's asking a bunch of the right questions. But something I noticed, you know, the cliffhanger at the last episode, and I apologize for the fire trucks you may hear in the background, but there have been a slew of Con Edison explosions in manholes around the neighborhood, and one severely injured a neighbor of mine three blocks away yesterday morning when he was walking his dog. But I digress. But Dooley, at the end of the last episode, you saw the Fringe typewriter typing out a message of some kind. And then in this episode, you have Dooley waiting for some Virginia DC code guy to break the code, and he can't, so Peggy Carter does. My point is, we never saw the code come out of the typewriter. Is it possible that Dooley got some instructions as a double agent and provided his own set of instructions and coordinates for Peggy and the Howling Commandos?
That is an interesting theory. I don't think so. Because of the way he's investigating, I think that the actions just took place off screen with that. But that is, I mean, I've been wrong before, and you've been right when I've been wrong. So that definitely is a possibility. I'll go off on my moment on this, because this was sloppy writing, and they could just make a claim that, well, in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, there was a vice president in 1946. But here's the thing. In 1946, the United States of America did not have a vice president of the United States.
That's right.
And some of you might wonder, Josh, that's crazy talk. How could we not have a vice president? Well, when a president died, in this case, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Harry Truman became president. Pursuant to the Presidential Succession Act of 1886, there was no way for us to appoint a VP. That didn't come about until the 25th Amendment after Kennedy was killed. So, looking at the law that was on hand, because it was rewritten in 1947, the Secretary of State, in this case, James F. Baines, would have been the president if Truman had died. And Truman would not have a VP until he was reelected in his own right as president. And Albin Barkley from South Carolina became vice president on what would have been the first January inauguration day in 1949. So when Dooley is saying he's talking to the vice president because the vice president's calling at odd hours, we didn't have one.
Or it was his imaginary friend speaking.
There's that. It would have made sense if, say,
Secretary of War. Secretary of War in those days.
Yeah, that would have made sense because the defense changes didn't come until 47 or 48 with the creation of the Air Force from extracted from the Army, and the Secretary of War became the Secretary of Defense because we didn't want to have a Secretary of War anymore. We thought Secretary of Defense sounded better. So that was like a glaring boo-boo that could have been cured with a Google search by the writer if they had actually looked up, hey, who was vice president in 1946? Because we didn't have one. But I digress. Let's talk about the Charm School. And when we go to the Charm School, we're introduced to the Howling Commandos. We get to see them again. And you spotted something from the comics that I had completely forgotten about, and let's talk about that.
Well, along with Dum Dum Dugan, who is filling in for Nick Fury in this universe as the leader of the Howling Commandos, there's Happy Sam Sawyer, a recreation of another character who is now a black member of the Commandos. There's Percival Pinkerton, the British officer who's attached to the Commandos. And there's a young guy by the name of Jonathan Jr. Juniper. And as soon as I saw Juniper in the episode last night, I realized he was unlikely to make it out of this episode alive. And he didn't. He was killed. And Juniper is famous in the Marvel Universe for being the first ever comic book character to die in action. And he's never been brought back. Dead is dead in this case. He was killed, I think, in issue 3 or issue 4 of Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos back around, I'm going to say 1966. So he died in issue 4, and that death's haunted Nick Fury all the way up to the modern day stories in the comic book world. But they killed him off about a third of the way into the episode last night. And we'll probably see some repercussions of that with Dum Dum Dugan because he seemed particularly hard hit by the loss.
Agreed. And it happened so quickly because Dum Dum gets stabbed and quickly Junior takes a bullet. I was like, whoa, you know, that was you blink, it happens so fast, it's over. And that was fascinating.
Just like war.
Yeah, yeah. But let's talk about going to the charm school. So if they're in Lithuania, where they either went through Lithuania or the school was located in Lithuania.
I thought it was Belarusia.
Okay, okay. They mentioned Lithuania, which at that point would have been occupied by the Soviet Union and a Soviet state after being independent for a while. Post-World War II, the Soviets claimed it. Their actions would be an incursion onto Soviet soil, which would be grounds for war. Stalin would not take that lying down. However, finding a spy school dedicated to teaching kids how to be Americans by watching Snow White and how to snap somebody's neck, they might want to cover that up. They might let that one slide. And it reminded me of Nelson DeMille's book, The Charm School, which I read back in high school, freshman year of high school, and where American POWs from Vietnam were used to train Russian spies on how to be American. And this was similar, except they were using Disney material and subliminal messages to teach little girls how to be killing machines.
Though there are those that say that is very common in terms of the use of Disney material, but again, we digress there. The other thing they were using was subliminal messaging in the projection of the Disney cartoon about conformity and obedience and things like that. Plus, the schoolroom that they found at the charm school was very eerie, as Peggy said. It's, you know, sort of sent a chill up her knickers. You know, posters of Franklin and Jefferson and Washington, I think, and a lot of Americana. It was very clear that whoever was being taught there was being taught how to pass as an American. And I think in the world of that day, that would have been considered a very big deal, you know, because America was very concerned after World War II about sleeper agents.
Yeah, basically, you prove McCarthy right. So it's just really scary. But yeah, that would be, you know, I mean, there were some great lines while investigating there with, you know, I'm sorry I didn't wear knickers, you know, tight, you know, that sort of play on things. But yeah, super creepy, super creepy. And
yeah. Have you ever read The Haunted Wood?
I have not.
It's a great book. It came out a few years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and it was co-authored by a former KGB agent who gave the American co-author a treasure trove of access to KGB files. And what they did basically was link up the KGB side of communiques that the Americans had from back in the day. And they sort of combined them to see what was going on. And it basically proved that there were a large number of Americans on the Soviet payroll, including a New York City congressman who was the head of the House Un-American Activities Committee before it became known as the HUAC. It was named something else. And he was taken off that committee because they suspected that he was actually a Soviet agent. Wow. And this book, The Haunted Wood, it's very scary, and it goes into some great detail, labor unions, you know, business, government, academia. And again, these are KGB files that prove who they had working for them and what kind of information they were gathering. Scary stuff. But, you know, as soon as I saw that last night, I thought about it because the scientist that they ended up taking back, the doctor, something's not kosher about that whole thing. I think that this whole thing was a setup to get them to think they were rescuing this guy. You know, you'll notice he shot the other doctor, the other professor, just as Peggy was beginning to reason with him in the hostage standoff. So, I don't know. I just got a bad feeling about this guy.
Yeah, they should vet him a little more. And I agree. Because if Leviathan knew the SSR had the typewriter, and they suspected that one of them could translate the message, it screams trap. It screams total trap. And that they're trying to get a man on the inside to cause havoc at the SSR. So I think that will play out because it's too convenient otherwise. And the characters being the good American or allies, since we do have our British allies in this as well, we're used to rescuing people. It's what we do.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, prisoners in a death camp, we'll go save them because that's what we do. And we expect people to have the same value system. And when they don't, it's that betrayal because it goes against our very nature. So I wouldn't be surprised if they're playing our nature against ourselves in the Charm School. So it makes total sense.
Now, what about Sousa? Sousa apparently is on to Peggy now, but he's always been her staunchest ally in the office.
I think he'll confront her, but since Sousa thinks, I think he's going to take his time. It's obvious he hasn't slept, and this has really freaked him out, and he's been thinking about it. But he will either confront her and try to get an answer and an explanation, which might go badly or lead to Peggy on the run, or he goes right to Dooley with it. But the fact that Dooley's appearing analytical and trying to figure out, okay, what's exactly happening here, and Sousa's naturally thoughtful, you know, I want to believe that there's a step in between, that you know, somebody else outs Peggy or some other event causes it, as opposed to Sousa just ringing the dinner bell. So, but we'll find out on Tuesday. So we'll, she obviously ends up on the run, and that's going to happen. But I love the pace of this, where in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., she has withered on the vine in indecision until Winter Soldier came out. Agent Carter progresses with each episode. Things happen for a reason. Some episodes might be a tad slower than some of the other ones, but this is moving at a really good click.
It's a tighter show in many ways, not the least of which is because it's only 8 episodes as opposed to the 20 plus that Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has to deal with. It's also a period show, which I think gives it a certain panache and veneer that makes it kind of interesting because it's happened 60 some odd years in the past. Having said that, though, more interesting characters in many ways, better action. The look and feel of the show is just terrific. And, you know, with the exception of their potential error about the vice president, it seems like they've really done a good job to nail down, you know, what life was like in the post-war era.
Agreed. And, you know, granted, you know, I had to think about the history of going, wait a minute, we didn't have a VP in 1946. How many other people caught that?
Very few, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
But that's a good sign that, you know, people are so into the show that they're willing to, you know, let something not like that slide. Or like you and I, to suggest that, you know, maybe the vice president in the Marvel Universe is, you know, they've changed things a little bit. And maybe there is somebody there and he's there for a reason.
Uh-huh.
We'll find out in the next few episodes, hopefully, what that reason is.
Agreed. So time will tell.
Yeah.
Well, with that, my friend, let's stay tuned. Let's stay geeky, and we'll watch Agent Carter next week. So thank you.
Take care, Josh.
You too, Jerry.